Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear the Centennial Alumnus Lecture presented by the UNO Religious Studies Program. The guest speaker will be Nikolai Roddy, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies at Creighton University, co-director of the Bethsaida Excavations Project, Senior Editor for the Journal of the Orthodox Center for the Advancement of Biblical Studies, and the author of The Romanian Version of the Testament of Abraham, Text, Translation, and Cultural Context. He'll speak on the topic, World Religions and the Global Community. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 23, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Dale Stover, Professor Emeritus in the University of Nebraska at Omaha's Religious Studies Program.
I began my teaching career here at UNO in 1968. At that time, I joined Russ Palmer, who's sitting over here now. He's retired too. He's emeritus professor too. He was the only faculty member in religious studies from 1965 to 1968. In 1971, Ron Burke was hired, and there were three of us teaching religious studies. And then in 1976, Jonathan Rosenbaum joined us, and we had a faculty of four, plus some help from Joe Sager, who was a visiting professor at UNO from 1976 to 1981. Now, I mention these because it's kind of the beginning of our religious studies faculty and our Bachelor of Arts program here in religious studies, but also because it was during the middle and late 1970s that Nikolai Roddy was studying, and this is the gang that he was studying with. Nikolai received his Bachelor of Arts degree in 1979. Now, when a retired professor tries to think back to more than 30 years ago, which is what this would be for me, to remember back to his day when he was a student, that's more than 30 years ago. And as I say, when a retired professor tries to do that, sometimes his or her memory can go blank or play tricks of some kind or another. Nevertheless, I think I can remember when Nikolai was in a junior level class I was teaching called Religions of the West, which focused on Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And I think I can remember that I had assigned the reading of a book on Eastern Orthodox Christianity by Timothy Ware. And one day in class, in the midst of my effort to explain the Orthodox understanding of the doctrine of theosis, I think I heard something go click over in where Nikolai was sitting. And his eyes seemed to register a double take of some kind. At any rate, something happened that awakened Nikolai's remembrance, it seemed to me, of his Romanian Orthodox heritage. And the passion of that reawakening, I'm thinking maybe, is what took him all the way to New York City, where he graduated with a Master of Arts degree from St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Seminary in 1989. And as befitting a scholar of Orthodox Christianity background, he went on to study early Judaism and early Christianity, you know, digging into the roots of the history of Christianity. And so he did his PhD studies in that field of study at the University of Iowa, graduating there with his PhD in 1999. And now, Orthodox Christianity has traditionally emphasized the presence of the sacred in the material forms of life and liturgy. So maybe it's not surprising that Nikolai has been drawn to the study of archaeology, you know, material culture. And for the past 12 years, he has co-directed the Bethsaida Excavations Project, which is based here at UNO, representing Creighton University in that project. And a number of other universities are involved in the project as well. So he's played a prominent role in that. His scholarly research has been recognized and published in a variety of forms, and you see some of the titles on the announcement brochure you have there on your chairs. Book chapters, books, journal articles, and the like. And he serves as a senior editor for the New Journal of the Orthodox Center for the Advancement of Biblical Studies. And I can also vouch to you that Nikolai established himself among us who were knowledgeable faculty members as a talented university teacher. Before he was hired at Creighton University here in Omaha, he taught courses in our program here at UNO for several semesters and was a genuine favorite for many students. Already in 2003, over six years ago now, in the spring of 2003, our religious studies faculty here at UNO cited him as a distinguished alumnus. And we are now, in 2009, particularly proud to have him address us as our centennial lecturer. So I ask you to welcome Associate Professor of Hebrew Bible and Old Testament Studies at Creighton University, Nikolai Roddy.
Wow. Well, I can't even follow an introduction like that. Thank you very much, Dale, Dr. Stover. Good evening, everyone. Do you like having the doors open? I love it. And I thought it would be appropriate to show you the windows landscape. And you can almost smell the grass, can't you? It's wonderful. Anyway, first off, I would like to thank Dr. Bill Blizek and colleagues of the Department of Philosophy and Religion for inviting me to speak to you this evening and to be part of the College of Arts and Sciences centennial celebration. I didn't realize that I was the first in the series, which is kind of a relief. I don't have a bar to jump over. I can set it pretty much wherever it's going to fall tonight, but I promise to do my best. And I'm very honored to do that and to be part of a very distinguished lineup of speakers. Indeed, I, as Dr. Stover told you, I was a 1979 graduate here of the Department of Philosophy and Religion. I had just turned 10, I think. I was a prodigy. But those years I spent here as an undergraduate student in the Department of Philosophy and Religion were among some of the most formative of my life, ranking right up there probably with ego individuation and toilet training, and helping to establish the personal career trajectory that has brought me to you this evening. So this is not the usual polite thanks that one expects here to hear at the beginning of a public talk to these mentors of mine. It's an expression of deepest gratitude. Although they were probably not aware of it at the time, I'm not sure I was. My professors, who we've mentioned already, primarily Bill Blizek, Dale Stover, Russ Palmer, Jonathan Rosenbaum, Ron Burke, and Joe Sager, were not only engaged in the business of imparting information and skills in the study of philosophy and religion, but were also indirectly involved in the enterprise of character building, which I'm not sure was something included in their job descriptions. In any case, it's always been a source of great comfort in particularly trying times, knowing just who to blame. To be sure, as a second-generation Romanian-American from a blue-collar family, son of an eighth-grade dropout, and the first of my family ever to attend a college or university, it was here that I learned how to think, in all of thinking's various forms. Dr. Blizek taught me to think critically, not exclusively, Russ Palmer taught me to think practically and systematically. Ron Burke did as well. Dale Stover taught me to think inclusively and metaphysically. Jonathan Rosenbaum, in classes on Judaism and Jewish tradition, taught me to think ethically and traditionally. And along with Dr. Stover's brilliant recollection, I mean, I was transported back sitting in that corner of the room, and everything he said was exactly how it happened and triggered those things in my mind all over again. To appreciate my own rootedness in Eastern Orthodox Christian culture and to attempt to live out its higher values in an authentic and principled way. Last but not least, Joe Sager, my former professor in archaeology, now friend and colleague in archaeology, taught me to think creatively and recreatively, lighting the path for choosing a lasting career that still feels like some incredibly delightful hobby, as well as deal with the practical crises of less enduring things like, well, like marriage in our respective cases. In any case, I trust I will not shame any of these people this evening. The topic I'll be addressing this evening in a very general way has to do with the importance of studying the human phenomenon we call religion, focusing specifically on the traditions of wisdom as found in religions, all religions throughout the world. I believe that greater knowledge and awareness of the phenomenon of religion would provide interested learners across academic disciplines and professions a broader and straighter avenue for peaceful and effective initiatives undertaken within a global context. Given the horrendous events of the 20th century and well into the 21st, this should not be a hard sell at all. Pan-European anti-Jewish violence spanning centuries and coming to a head in Europe's middle in the mid-20th century, the breakup of Yugoslavia along religious and cultural lines in the 1990s, and the deadlocked fundamentalist cry of God is on our side, echoing between Christian fundamentalists at the pinnacle of power in the U.S. and a few of their Islamic fundamentalist counterparts on the other side of the world, just to give a few of the more obvious examples, should serve to make the point that the study of religion is at least helpful, if not essential, for arriving at a thorough understanding of what it may mean, both merely and ultimately, to be human, and thereby offering an effective and perhaps the only real chance for addressing widespread violence and bloodshed committed in the names of religion's various tenets and deities. Indeed, involved as I am in the study of human material remains through the field of archaeology, I'm aware that religion, or what most casual observers would agree looks a lot like religion, is a universal human phenomenon, and that it's found in the earliest stages of Homo sapiens, as well as in human cultures throughout the world today. I've experienced the excitement of exploring Paleolithic sites in the geographical corridor human beings followed from their origins in Africa, including a famous Neanderthal site known as the Caves of Amud, where in the early 1990s, paleontologists uncovered the grave of a young Neanderthal female who some 60,000 years before present had been laid to rest, apparently lovingly, with a garland of flowers around her neck, according to the pollenologists, the pollen studies, and the thigh bone of a young red deer on her chest. Other sites like the Caves of Lascaux in southwestern France and elsewhere throughout Europe offer evidence strongly suggesting the practice of human propitiation of the forces of nature. Such ceremonial awe in the face of death's alarming and unpredictable ultimacy is an experience of perceived sacred that lies at the very root of religion. And today, some 60,000 years later, one finds no culture on the face of the planet lacking what the most casual of observers would identify as religion, as elusive as the term may actually be to define. In the Western Hemisphere, from the bold and I might add necessary tradition of skepticism arising in the Enlightenment, to the reasoned observations and assertions proffered today by such thinkers as Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and others, religion itself as a phenomenon seems hardly to have noticed. So as such, an expansive and enduringly entrenched human activity, perhaps religion as a subject ought to be taken more seriously, studied critically at a variety of levels and in a variety of instructional contexts. As a student as early as junior high school, I recall being struck by the fact that of the several conflicts going on in various parts of the world at that time, Northern Ireland being the one that comes most readily to mind, religion often seemed to be a common denominator. As I learned later, here at UNO, as a matter of fact, what appeared to be wars of religion were never, or at least almost never, primarily over religion at all, but arising out of human fears and concerns, real and perceived, in response to various socioeconomic factors related to the distribution of wealth and the acquisition of power. One of the most recent textbook examples of this that comes to mind is the violent dissolution of the former state of Yugoslavia, that uneasy alliance of southern Slavs that was masterfully held together for a time by Marshal Josip Broz Tito, but erupting in horrible bloodbaths during the 1990s. The egomaniacal ambitions that took place among Slobodan Milosevic, Franjo Tuđman, and Alija Izetbegović were fueled by popular fears in unstable economic conditions, which, by the way, some have traced to Reagan-era interference in the post-Tito affairs of what was arguably the most successful socialist state ever. In any case, Yugoslavia's centralized economy suffered in its struggle to pay back loans called in by the World Bank and the IMF. Prices skyrocketed, salaries dwindled, unemployment levels rose drastically, roiling deep-seated, long-held fears and leftover anxieties to the surface, compelling people to divide up and cling desperately, like iron shavings around a magnet, to their personal centers of perceived ultimacy, experienced within their respective ethno-religious communities, Orthodox Christian Serb, Roman Catholic Croat, and Muslim Bosnian. The architectural symbols of their communities, churches, mosques, cemeteries, thus became ready and effective targets, piercing the enemy's very heart and provoking unspeakably violent reactions. So that's where it stands. Homo sapiens is also both homo religiosus and, sadly, also homo truciderus, the murdering animal. So even if I cannot convince you that the study of religion is one of the best handles for coming to understand what it might mean to be human, perhaps at this point you will understand why at least this undergraduate student chose a religious studies major here in UNO's Department of Philosophy and Religion. So given that religion, arguably the most salient aspect of culture, offers an effective handle for exploring what it may mean to be human, how might one carry out the enterprise in a way that may effectively equip tomorrow's leaders, and what might be involved in such a process? Perhaps most obviously, the study of religion as expressed in today's living religions leads to a greater knowledge and awareness of the cultural other. It might help to know, for example, that the firm handshake that people exchange in the predominantly Christian West as a sign of confidence and sincerity, as in, really glad to meet you, George, or really glad to meet you, Martha, let's do business, is an individualistic gesture experienced as a sign of animosity, even aggression, by Arab Christians and Muslims alike. It might be interesting to know that the virgin birth of Jesus is recounted in the Quran, or that Arab Christians, along with Muslims, address their prayers to Allah, the Arabic word for the God. And it might be personally enlightening to consider that the God up there for most monotheists is the God in here for Hindus and Jains and not a few Jesuits these days. Okay, I'm at Creighton. That would have gotten a big laugh. It flopped here. I'm willing to admit that. And for many others elsewhere in the world. In sum, the study of religion opens the door to the world of the other. Knowledge and understanding of the culture of the other helps eliminate misunderstanding and opens doorways to peace. In addition to the study of a particular other, the study of religion can also lead to a better understanding of otherness in general. Human beings seem to relate to one another so much better when they meet outside themselves, even if they happen to share the same basic religious tradition. If the same methodology by which one scrutinizes and judges amid the multiplicity of other religions is directed toward one's own religious community, one's own communal tenets and practices, suddenly, in looking at oneself objectively, self-critically, as from the outside. A thinking person cannot help but become somewhat less haughty, less egocentric, more self-aware. One may come to see that one's own rituals and myths tend to the same basic functions and purposes as the others. Now, I realize that this may provoke some sort of reaction to suggest that our own deepest held convictions about the world and its origins lie within the realm of this sadly misunderstood term myth. My students at Creighton University, which, as I just mentioned, was a Jesuit and Catholic institution, most of you know, raise eyebrows of suspicion, sometimes even alarm, when they hear me refer to the creation stories in the opening chapters of the book of Genesis as myth. So far, I've been able to qualify the statement before they've had a chance to call Omaha's new archbishop in order to tell him about the godless heretic teaching in his archdiocese. To be sure, in popular discourse, myth is a word usually applied to an untrue statement, something with no intrinsic value, often placed in contradistinction to the word fact. Indeed, for many, the West's cosmogony or story of creation is somehow exclusively real and true, if not actually factually historical, while everyone else's cosmogony is just a myth. But ignoring or devaluing the power of a living myth can be, has been, a dangerous thing. The power of myth, because of its perceived experience of ultimacy, is such that it has a kind of life of its own. Under certain conditions, latent myths can be triggered and can rise up to wreak great human devastation. Case in point, the horrific destruction that resulted from Adolf Hitler's successful manipulation of Teutonic and Christian symbolism during the Third Reich. But I doubt even Hitler was able to envision the full scope of destructive power inherent in his propaganda machine's demonic hybridization of these myths. Returning to the example of Yugoslavia's dissolution, the myth of Tsar Lazar's defeat by Sultan Murat I at Kosovo Polje, the Field of Blackbirds, in 1389, which is essentially a rationalization of the defeat based on the idea that Tsar Lazar essentially traded his earthly kingdom for a heavenly one, is so ingrained in the Serbian psyche, passed down in epic oral genres for over 600 years, that many Serbs presented with a perceived threat of loss would no more relinquish influence over the affairs of Kosovo and its numerous medieval monasteries than many of their traditional Jewish counterparts would hand over Jerusalem. Thus, one must be aware of the fact that a living myth is never something untrue or unreal, neither is it ever just a story. Quite the opposite. A myth is true in the sense that it conveys ultimacy, arising out of a culture, reflecting the culture, and reinforcing a culture. A myth is a window to infinitude, to ultimacy, to God, whatever word you want to use in referring to it, in referring to that gaping, open question of consciousness and existence, which religions inadequately and only feebly attempt to answer. Cosmogonies, myths of cosmic origins, not only recall, but invite participation in the birth and ongoing operation of the universe, thereby providing for a predictable, orderly maintenance of the present world. A Western fundamentalist Christian and a Western atheist, with all the varying degrees of belief and skepticism in between, can sit reasonably at the same table and have a coherent discussion about the nature of the cosmos and its beginnings, introducing into the conversation something as foreign to Western thought as Shinto cosmogony or Buddhist convictions about the nature of ultimate reality would very likely add an alien third dimension to this two-dimensional panel, disrupting the thread of seriously engaged discourse, or at least making it necessary to realign it. Interwoven with and actualized through myth is ritual, routinized behaviors carried out in a sacred context that function to relieve societal anxiety by providing a reliably predictable way for maintaining the good order of the cosmos. Whether making the sign of the cross, prostrating oneself five times a day toward the east, baptizing in the name of Jesus by full immersion, meditating upon the Dharma wheel, as Strange as one's rituals may seem to another, it must not be overlooked that all rituals participate in the realities they envision and consciously experience. And all are concerned with the ongoing orderly and predictable maintenance of the universe. All rituals may be, and often are, performed perfunctorily, but they should never be devalued in their role as powerful representations of perceived ultimacy. As symbolic expressions of this ultimate reality, myth and ritual stand alongside other powerful symbolic conveyances such as territory, persons, and objects. What I would like us to consider during the remainder of our time together this evening is a very significant but often obscure and recessive aspect of religion, yet the only part of religion that seems to be able to transcend itself as well as to allow one to transcend the perceived distance between ourselves and the other, and perhaps even more importantly, to initiate a self-critical examination of one's own state of otherness. For want of a better term, I will use the word wisdom in referring to this vital component of religion. Whether or not it is self-consciously defined as such, wisdom, as we will seek to identify and define it, can be found among all the religions of the world. Ironically, however, wisdom never seems to stand out front in religion. Generally speaking, it is lacking in creedal formulas, theological treatises, dogmatic assertions, and such. But it is preserved and presented primarily in the form of enduring epic, folk tales, fables, and other culture-specific popular genres, and in the literate religions, embedded discreetly among its sacred writings. I'm fully convinced that if our students, the leaders of tomorrow, could somehow be exposed to the rich treasury of the world's religions, the world's wisdom in particular, including especially their own wisdom inheritance, whatever that happens to be, they just might act in less fearful, knee-jerk ways when confronted by the perceived or real threat of another. That they might not react in the usual default mode of violence or recede in fear, the old fight or flight response, or reaction rather, but respond, because I'm making a distinction here between reacting and responding, but respond to such situations on the basis of better informed, more thought out, more self-critically aware, hence less destructive options. It is my thesis that in light of the vast diversity of human culture, human wisdom arising as distinct expressions of how best to live in the world tends to unite and reconcile oppositions between the self and the other, as well as orienting one properly within the natural world, and that for this reason alone is worthy of study as a means for solving conflict. Please keep in mind that I have chosen to focus analytically but selectively on some general characteristics of human wisdom, and that I am not attempting to present any sort of mini-course in comparative religions. In fact, this presentation will do absolutely no justice to any of the world's traditions. Selective generalizations are, by their very nature, distortions of reality, and Weberian ideal types do not exist apart from the world of ideas. Nevertheless, I've noticed some commonalities along the way, and it is only these reasoned observations I wish to present to you tonight. The first general observation I would like to make about the major wisdom traditions of the world is that they all seem to be involved in the attempt to peer beneath or beyond the mere surface of things in order to gain a truer, more authentic view of ultimate reality, however that may come to be envisioned. The glimpse of reality that wisdom promises is often at paradox with everyday mundane experience, therefore opening up possibilities for a happier, more satisfied existence, or in some cases, non-existence, within the world. I find some examples helpful here. The dynamics of this process may be seen on a personal level in one's usual reaction to, say, a person who is perceived as being arrogant and egotistical. By applying and engaging in the principle that I'm suggesting all wisdom traditions share, namely the attempt to peer beneath the surface of things to arrive at a truer view of reality, one may come to two realizations. One, that a particular characteristic we despise in someone else upon rigorous self-examination often turns out to be a trait that we ourselves possess, but we're simply not aware. And two, that arrogance and egotism are really only surface manifestations of something deeper and more authentic, namely fear and insecurity. And when the judging person realizes that beneath the surface of things, fear and insecurity manifesting itself in egotism is a shared condition, one no longer has the energy to react divisively, but can now respond with greater understanding, perhaps even compassion. By responding rationally, as opposed to merely reacting, more favorable outcomes may be achieved for everyone involved. New levels of awareness about the other and within the self are opened up, a connection is made, and the anxieties produced by fear and loathing are thereby avoided. Similarly, wisdom traditions offer themselves as bridges extended outward toward one another that, if utilized, could help dispel a community's fears and anxieties, but one needs first to hear the call of one's own wisdom tradition as an antidote against fear. Fear of the world, specifically fear of others in the world, is often the main culprit in conflict and aggression, lying insidiously within the human person and collectively in a society, so that under perceived threat conditions, it bubbles to the surface, taking the form of either withdrawal or violence. And when fear is acknowledged, named, and identified for what it is, one's thinking becomes freer, more reality-based options appear, and more often than not, productively purposeful human behavior will ensue. Reciprocally, then, acting courageously on the basis of that newer, more authentic insight this new freedom produces reinforces purposefully productive thinking in return. Such are the ways of the wisdom traditions of the world. In seeing the truer natures and actual operative processes lying beneath or beyond the mere surface of things. Fundamental to the respective wisdom traditions of the world, raising the need for a truer and hence happier or at least more favorable glimpse of things and providing an antidote to fear, is the simple observation that life is not what it might be. Judaism sees a world in need of tikkun, a Hebrew word that connotes meaning along the lines of healing or repairing, restoring wholeness. For Christianity, life is often described as a veil of tears in which one prepares for a blessed afterlife. For Buddhists, the fact that existence is suffering is axiomatic, the first of the Four Noble Truths. No one seems immune to the difficulties of existence, for under certain conditions, life can overcome anyone. Even the author of that mother of all self-help books, M. Scott Peck, I think, The Road Less Traveled, many of you might be familiar with that, who for so many years seemed to millions of readers to have the ultimate answer for overcoming the difficulties of life in order to overcome life's obstacles and become truly happy, has, by most reliable reports at the end of the day, ironically become mired down in bitterness, despair, and regret. Given that human beings exist in a less than perfect world, a world of suffering, we see that the wisdom traditions begin with the human condition. The Western world's prevailing myth, deriving from the overarching narrative of the Hebrew Bible, makes a plea to wisdom in light of its own presuppositions regarding the nature of human being in the world. At the very beginning of its story, Eve looks at the forbidden tree and seeing that, quote, the tree is good for food and to be desired to make one wise, she reaches out, takes, and eats. The biblical God, jealous of God's own unique status, will not allow these creatures to eat from both trees and thereby become like God, as the serpent rightly observes. So they must be expelled into the world outside paradise, the world of toil. It may be regarded as a step up into fuller existence, but that fuller existence requires the wisdom that was stolen from the garden to be applied in order to survive. Indeed, Eve in the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition is regarded as the mother of all humans. And indeed, just as she reached out for wisdom, so it is that wisdom is regarded in so many religious traditions as universal, relevant for humankind. For the West,
Biblical wisdom transcends Israelite social boundaries. Job, for example, the wisdom figure par excellence, like all things mystical and magical, comes from the East. The land of Uz is, etymologically speaking, not likely in the Levant. And while the Most High is presumed to be the God over and above all the world, and that Hasatan, the heavenly accuser, walks up and down to and fro upon it, there is a sense in which the plight of Job is a universal human predicament. For indeed, suffering is universal. But the solution to this predicament, as worked out in the process by Job in dialogue with his three wise fellows, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, a mysterious young sage named Elihu, and ultimately the Most High himself, is that in passing from self-perceived righteousness into the sin of an egotistical self-righteousness, Job finally comes to the acceptance that beneath the illusory surface of things, namely the traditional two-ways scenario laid out in Deuteronomy and in older traditional wisdom forms like the Book of Proverbs, that fear of the Lord, understood as respect for the awesome majesty of the ultimate, leads to health and wealth, while wickedness leads to poverty, sickness, and death, and that ultimately the answer to human suffering remains a gaping, open question for Job, a mystery to which he can only helplessly submit himself. Notice also here how the wisdom tradition of the West self-negates, self-corrects, and transcends itself, which brings us to another feature of wisdom traditions everywhere. I find that another common feature in the world's wisdom traditions is that they seem to share a principle of self-negation. Indeed, if one desires to remain with an authentic existence, whatever form that takes, one must accept the fact that projections of what that may look like are ultimately infinite, or in Western terms, idolatrous. The prophetical tradition in the Hebrew Bible is self-conscious of this. That is why Moses is said to have died at the age of 120, his eyes undimmed, his vigor unabated, which in its context means he needed neither glasses nor sexual enhancements, and that no one knows to this day where he's buried. The point is, it's not about Moses, lest you go and build a shrine to him. It's about ultimacy. It's the same with Elijah, who after being taken up in a whirlwind, after which his disciple Elisha tells the prophetic wannabes, who after 3 days of searching for the master's body, coming back empty-handed, says, "I told you so." All around the world, the most authentically human are those who know their status in relation to ultimacy. Humility, self-emptying, generosity, compassion. As Paul Tillich observed, an authentic religious symbol becomes so through the principle of self-negation. Because the wisdom traditions of the world strive for a truer view of reality that reduces fears and anxieties and allows them to become more inclusive, predisposing them toward a more universal inclusivity, authenticates themselves through the paradox of self-negation, then it just makes sense that things like generosity, nonviolence, and even compassion would follow. And this is where we begin to enter into the territory of doctrine and self-presentation in the religions of the world. Once we have been safely carried over by underlying wisdom to this point in any religion, we are then free to begin acknowledging and appreciating the differences of others in a way that transcends the things that divide us. But how elusive this wisdom can be, it is something that must be sought out, looked hard for in the pages of sacred texts. Not so much in the strangeness of other religions and other worldviews, this is certainly part of the challenge, but especially within our own personal religious and cultural traditions first, whatever that happens to be, whether skeptic or believer or atheist. And to understand that it is in our own self-interest as members of a human family to stop being satisfied with the mere surface appearance of our perceptions, to self-question, self-examine, and where necessary, self-negate, to accept the truer view of reality that wisdom promises as an antidote to fear and the violence it produces among human beings. The Buddhist prays facing west, the direction of the Buddhist paradise. While for monotheists, praying toward the east is the traditional orientation. However, it is only through the window of human wisdom, through the rigorous self-examination of the self, that one may hope to gain a more authentic, higher, more transcendent view of that which all human communities and religions only in part perceive. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the question. I visited Kosovo last year, and I was wondering if you see something that maybe I saw, and I'm thinking I'm seeing this. I'm wanting to see if someone else from that tradition sees it. Some of the angry rhetoric that is focused on the "we're all in this together," like from the Barack Obama, from the Tea Parties to the September 12th marches and some of the leadership, Glenn Beck on Fox News and all that. Do you sense any resonation or any kind of similarity with the rhetoric that some of the leaders in Serbia had when they were protesting against their central government and things like that?
The one thing in common, I mean, without a thorough analysis of the rhetoric, generally speaking, the one thing that I see in common on actually everywhere is the insidiousness of fear and the ability of people who are inherently fearful themselves but in denial, who somehow masterfully, successfully manipulate fear for their own personal ends. I do see the commonality. I better stop myself right there or I'll get on a big soapbox, and I don't know if this is the proper place for that. Thank you for your question. Any others?
You've talked about what individuals can do. Is there anything in this for cultures that would make a culture something that would affect, influence, change a culture?
Unfortunately, you know, I've known people who are very idealistic. They want to save the world and the whales and everything else. But the 50-foot radius around them is crap. Their relationships were terrible. They're just a mess. A train wreck. But you liked them. They're cool. They like reggae and they hang out. And you can just do all kinds of wonderful things with them. And they'll never, they might do you wrong if it serves them. But the point I'm making here is that as much as I would love to change the world myself, I really can't. That's a tough realization. All I can do is take care of the 50-foot radius around me. So, my relationships haven't been the great. I just went through my third divorce, I'm embarrassed to say. But the principle of self-negation, here I am, in honesty and authenticity, to make the point. You try to do the best you can. I have children, and they are the joy of my life. So I think that I can contribute to the well-being of the world by being the kind of father that they deserve, the kind of instructor that my students deserve, the kind of friend that my friends deserve, that sort of thing. And that's about all the most I can hope for. But that's a great question. Yes, sir.
You didn't mention anything about politics and religion. Mm. And it seems to me that that is some kind of a nexus of the conflicts that are connected with religion. And I've come to think that the separation of church and state, which is part of our heritage from Thomas Jefferson on down, that that was a good thing. Mm-hmm. After the religious wars of Europe, and our founders looked at what propelled those atrocities, they said, these are two different domains. Let's separate them out. Those who govern shall not tell those who follow what to believe in the domain of religion. That's a fairly simplistic belief on my part, and I just wonder how you relate that to your panorama of kind of religious motives, behaviors, and the rest of it.
I appreciate your comments and your question. I'm right there with you. Despite my rootedness in the Orthodox and hence Byzantine tradition, I'm self-critical enough to know that the symbol of Byzantium, the double-headed eagle, with the emperor as vicar of Christ and the patriarch of Constantinople, and that together this double-headed eagle rules the empire. Well, you know, I'm realistic enough to know that double-headed eagles, two-headed eagles, don't survive in nature. There's something perverted about that and unnatural. So I'm right with you in terms of that. And even though I did not specifically address the political situation, I would hope that you felt it as an underlying current underneath. And one of the reasons I backed off from my soapbox a few minutes ago with the last question and talking about the power structures and, you know, the lust for power and the way that fear is manipulated, I need to stop myself again, because I would love to make some very self-critical comments about our most recent years in this country as well as in other countries. So I think if these principles are provided in that 50-foot area around us, and we vote responsibly and take advantage of the benefits that we have in this country to separate religion from structures of power, I think that would be the best we can do, and I encourage you to do it. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard the Centennial Alumnus Lecture presented by the UNO Religious Studies Program. The guest speaker was Nikolai Roddy, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies at Creighton University, co-director of the Bethsaida Excavations Project, senior editor for the Journal of the Orthodox Center for the Advancement of Biblical Studies, and the author of The Romanian Version of the Testament of Abraham, Text, Translation, and Cultural Context. He spoke on the topic, World Religions and the Global Community. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 23rd, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Wendy Townley, Assistant Director for Media Relations at UNO, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.